Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In eastern Aleppo, Syria, regime forces and Russian and Iranian troops are moving in for the kill. The rebels cannot hold out forever. Citizens trapped there are trying to figure out how not to die. Flee into the arms of the regime? Stick it out with the rebels? High above them, the bigger story unfolds. Bashar al-Assad looks set to come out on top. This is not what Washington promised. And on the other side of this civil war, what then? This hour On Point, Syria and the Middle East with all of its players after Aleppo. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What if Assad wins after all this? What's left for Syrians? And from Russia to ISIS to Iran, what fallout awaits Donald Trump? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. My producer is struggling mightily here to get through to Syria, where CBS News correspondent Deborah Pata has been waiting to talk to us. But the lines out of Aleppo right now just too rough to put on air. We've got very knowledgeable observers from here. Robin Wright is with us. She joins us from Washington, contributing writer for The New Yorker, joint fellow at the Wilson Center, the U.S. Institute for Peace. Robin Wright, thanks very much for being with us today.
Great to be with you.
And with us from Norman, Oklahoma, Joshua Landis, Syria expert, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, author of the daily newsletter Syria Comment. Josh Landis, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Josh, what's the latest you're hearing out of Syria? Have the rebels lost? How close are they? Everybody seems to say at this point they are really up against it.
They are up against it. About 75% of eastern Aleppo, that's the part of the city that the rebels had held, have been conquered by the regime in the last month. And 150 medical cases from one of the hospitals have just been evacuated. As the regime took it over, they were taken out by Red Crescent helpers. So the situation, the rebel enclave is decreasing every day. New neighborhoods are being taken by the regime. There seems to be some chaos going on there. Civilians, many of whom are related to fighters, are panic-struck because they're being bombarded by the regime. They don't know where to flee to. They're worried that if they go into the regime regions, they won't get they'll get hauled aside and perhaps beaten or tortured in order to get rebel fighters. You don't know what's going to happen to you, and that's the big anxiety.
Robin Wright, if Aleppo falls to Assad, what is the significance of that for the broader civil war? It's been such a long, tough fight there. I mean, this war overall, what, half a million dead in these 4 or 5 years? Millions we've seen forced out of their homes and those waves of refugees that have hit the whole region and Europe. But for the civil war itself, if Aleppo falls, what does it mean, Robin?
This is a huge political and psychological turning point for everyone involved. And this is a war that has multiple layers. But the one between the rebels and President Assad has reached a critical turning point. Aleppo was important as the former commercial hub, a city that dates back millennia, the largest city in Syria. And so its loss to the rebels or by the rebels, means that Assad looks ever stronger. This is a man who 6 years ago, a lot of people thought could not survive a matter of weeks or months. And now he appears with the aid of Russia, Iran, and troops from Lebanon's Hezbollah to be surviving. Now, that doesn't mean the war is over. There are still big chunks of the country that are not under Assad's control. But this is a moment where any prospect of the rebels supported by the West have very diminished chances of being a viable alternative. It's hard to get equipment in. The outside world is basically turning their back on them. And the fact that President-elect Trump has indicated he's not willing to continue or is going to reconsider the kind of support the United States has given the rebels is going to be another blow that could be decisive in their fate.
Now, we've got U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Hamburg, Germany, talking with the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov about some kind of deal to have a truce or to evacuate Aleppo. But Deborah Pata with CBS is reporting out of there right now that the Assad regime is, quoting her here, showing no mercy as it pushes to regain full control. About 200,000 civilians still trapped. She writes, there is no civilization in Aleppo. Joshua Landis, looking at this turning point and turning toward what? Is this victory? Robin says it's not straight up victory in the Civil War. There's a patchwork of fighting all over the place. It's complicated. But this is an enormous win for Assad, who many in the Obama administration said would go.
Yes, it is a major turning point. Robin is absolutely correct. And it also included in this is that many of the militias that the United States was arming and training and hoped would be able to overturn the Assad regime were stationed in Aleppo, the moderate militias. And now that they are being defeated, the center of gravity for the rebellion goes to Idlib province and to Idlib city, this provincial city, which is dominated by al-Qaeda's branch, Nusra, and other Salafist militias like Ahrar al-Sham. It'll be very difficult for the United States and Western Europe to throw their support behind these more Salafist militias. And that is going to isolate the rebellion. And in a sense, it makes the prophecy of Assad come true, which is it's either me or radical Islamists. And he has, of course, helped make that prophecy come true by destroying the militias that the United States wanted to win. And that's, you know, that puts the rebellion in a very difficult position. And when you look around Syria, whether to the east, where ISIS is most strong, or to the west, where these Islamist Salafist militias are strong, one cannot see any particular leader who can challenge the Assad government today,
Josh, take
or
us,
any other group that's going to reconquer Syria other than him.
Take us back to the beginning of this bloody hell that's emerged here and suffering for so many people. What was it about at the beginning? It's become perhaps something else, but the rebellion was for?
It was for change. This regime, the Assad regime, has been ruling Syria since 1970 when Hafez al-Assad took power. Ba'athist regime, quasi-socialist, very corrupt at the top, and dominated by the security part of the regime, dominated by Alawite soldiers. This is a Shiite offspring, you know, an offshoot. And the people rose up from one end of the spectrum to the other in 2011 and the heels of the Arab Spring thinking, we want change. There were all kinds of people. Some were Democrats, but many were Islamists. And there was a big spectrum of what change meant. But
was it Sunni versus Shia at the beginning, Josh?
No, it was not. But you can't avoid the fact that in Syria, that there is an undertone of Sunni versus Shia because of the sectarian nature of the Assad regime, of the security part of the state, which had been controlled by Shia. In the same way that in Iraq, the Sunnis under Saddam Hussein had the lion's share of power. And when America went in there saying democracy, that meant putting Shiites on the top. And it meant Sunnis being thrown to the margins, and they all joined, you know, various rebel groups, not all, but many joined rebel groups or al-Qaeda, and you got this insurgency. And so the incipient sectarianism of these regimes turned into even greater sectarianism. And when you combine that with the growing Iran-Saudi showdown in the Middle East for power, a Sunni state like Saudi Arabia against a Shiite revolutionary state in Iran, it just added fuel to the fire, and this became a sectarian battle.
Robin Wright, we'll look at the big power interests here, and of course those extend directly to Moscow and Washington, but Iran and Saudi right there, proxy wars going on. But I want to just look at the situation of the Syrian people for a moment, Robin. We have seen massive flows, millions out of Syria, millions more displaced within Syria. What does it mean for the people of Syria if something like an Assad rule returns to Syria? And I realize it's a patchwork. They may be fighting and a sort of checkerboard here for a long time. But will we see a situation of more refugees going out or Syrians coming back home? What's it look? What's expected in the region, Robin?
This is the worst war of the 21st century, and the cost to the society, to the infrastructure of the state, has been unprecedented for any modern Middle East war. You look at the situation, and you've had over 4 million people who have fled the country in a country with 22 million people. You have more than half the population that's been displaced inside the country that has not yet fled. You have unemployment figures that get close to 60%. Two-thirds of the country is dependent on daily aid just for their daily bread. The devastation to society is unprecedented. And you look at Aleppo, and it is a microcosm of the destruction across the country. This is this wonderful old city that has been destroyed. There is very little for people to return to. And even in the unlikely prospect that you somehow return peace to most of the country in the near future, the question is whether people would be willing to come home. There are no homes. There's no business. There's no running water. Education is limited. Hospitals have been destroyed. What is the appeal of going home? And the danger is down the road that the brain trust in Syria, those who were the educated, who provided health care, who educated at the universities, that many of the brains would have left the country and don't want to return, and that you have those who are willing to return because they have no choice, because they're stuck in tents in refugee camps in the bordering countries. And so and then there's the question of what happens politically. And there are no ideas out there that will restore Syria to the kind of strong country that it once was, the geostrategic center in many ways of the Arab world, or the Levant anyway. Assad will still remain very unpopular after killing so many of his people. The sectarianism is very deep. Minorities feel threatened. This country is going to be very hard to reconstruct in any way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Syria and the Middle East. If Bashar al-Assad wins, he now looks set to take Aleppo, maybe in some way the overall civil war there. We're looking at where does that leave the country, the region, the U.S., Russia, Iran. It is a very full plate right now, as the regime forces are described as steamrolling what remains of rebel resistance in eastern Aleppo. Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov gave a press conference in Moscow Monday. He said rebels in Aleppo, he calls them terrorists, have two choices, leave or be destroyed.
Well, the fact that terrorists said they won't leave Aleppo doesn't mean anything. In any case, if they don't want to leave voluntarily, they would be destroyed. There is no other solution.
Russia's intervention in Syria and Aleppo has been massive and very brutally effective. Most of the few reporters in and around Aleppo now are moving with regime forces. Here's a report from Britain's Sky News filed yesterday from Aleppo.
Just as Russia did to Grozny in Chechnya, it is pulverizing Aleppo with its Syrian and Iranian allies. Pro-regime forces advancing deeper into the city. The Russian military claims the advance is freeing people in Aleppo.
The major part of eastern Aleppo was liberated. Not much is left.
Not much left. And here, part of a CNN report filed yesterday from Aleppo, speaking to a boy, then a man who fled the siege there into the arms of the regime as regime forces move in on the last rebel-held neighborhoods.
We were afraid that we would starve to death. We were also scared because heavy bombs were falling.
I wanted to leave with my kids 15 days ago, but the rebels shot at me and said, "Hey, you bastard, do you want to join the regime?"
Robin Wright is with us from The New Yorker. She's just back from the region. Joshua Landis is with us from Norman, Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma, Center of Middle East Studies there. You can join us as well this hour. We're all watching this. Aleppo resistance apparently crumble. What does an Assad win mean for the people of Syria, for Russian influence in the region, U.S. influence, ISIS, the Saudis, Iran? How does the U.S. come out of this looking? Will Assad end up an ally in the fight against ISIS? If Assad wins, what is the meaning of all the suffering we have seen? Josh, you know this country very well. If with the fall of Aleppo, if that's what we're about to see here, what do you imagine for the rest of the country? Could it be something like a victory for Assad in this civil war? If not victory, then what status and what circumstances for the people?
Well, it clearly will be hailed as a victory by Assad. And what we'll see, I think, is a new security architecture being spread over this part of the Levant, from Lebanon to Syria to Iraq, Iran. Iranian influence will establish what King Abdullah of Jordan called a Shiite crescent. That means that a region of the Middle East that's dominated by Shiite powers, and with Russian help and Iranian help. And the U.S. is letting this happen in a sense because it has a contradictory policy. On the one hand, it wants to isolate Iran and keep Iran limited and in its box. That's what it says it wants to do. But in order to destroy ISIS, the military strategy of the United States has been to help Shiite militias and the Shiite-dominated army of Baghdad conquer Iraq. And in a sense, to let the Russians conquer Syria. And that has played into the hands of the Iranian influence in the region. So the United States has been scratching its head on this question. It's saying one thing and doing the opposite in many ways. And I don't think they have a better solution, at least not one that they want to pay for. And that means that these Shiite centers of gravity have been able to assert their power. Now, once the war is over, the big question will be, does Syria become a North Korea?
Meaning?
Isolated by the world and locked into economic sanctions that will starve the people? Or will it be able to use Iraqi, Lebanese, Iranian, Chinese, Russian support in order to rebuild? And will the Syrian people, who are known as merchant and very savvy traders, be able to build their country again despite ongoing real approbation from the West and probably a sanctions system that will continue on for perhaps decades?
Josh, does that question that you raised there about what it will be presume that Assad will at some point, maybe soon, dominate most of geographic Syria? Or do you expect fighting to go on within the country for a long time?
Well, I think he will dominate. I do think there will be a lot of resistance, but I can't see anybody who's going to oppose the Syrian army inside Syria for a long time. About 50,000 troops were amassed in Aleppo by Assad in order to destroy what was 10,000 rebels in eastern Aleppo. It's going to be very hard for this new army, which has morale behind it and which the country is beginning to see as a winner. And it's causing a certain snowball effect. It's going to be hard for the rebels to stop this, particularly because their supporters are falling away. And that means – and ISIS, the biggest power that opposes Assad, is being destroyed by the United States. So in a sense, the U.S. is a strategic ally, even though it abhors Assad and what he's doing, is helping to destroy his enemies. And that – is going to play into his hands, and it's hard to see who is going to really challenge him in Syria for control of the country.
Robin Wright, if we see here then emerge what Joshua Landis calls this Shiite crescent from Syria across Iraq into Iran, and the U.S. is kind of acquiescing in this because this helps set up a framework for defeating ISIS, but does that then set up some much greater conflict between the Shia crescent and Saudi Arabia watching all of this, Robin?
Well, there are many wars playing out in Syria, and one of them is between Saudi Arabia and Iran over the balance of power in the region. It is not over religious dogma. It is over political influence. And so, yes, there's going to be greater tension, I think, between the two sects, in part because Sunnis feel so abandoned across the region, not just in Syria. But, you know, this is where we tend to forget that there is some progress being made against ISIS in Syria. ISIS has lost 27% of its territory to Kurdish, a largely Kurdish militia in the northeast. The question, of course, becomes if you do eventually force ISIS out, who does end up absorbing control of that territory? Is it Assad? Is it the rebels who beat ISIS back on the ground? And so there are still a lot of open questions. I think ISIS, even if it's forced out, will continue to be an insurgency in other parts of Syria. I think that there are some rebel pockets who are going to be opposed to the Assad regime. And I think most importantly, that the al-Qaeda franchise that's dominant in Idlib province, that working with local rebels there, will continue to try to hold on to Idlib. This is, of the five major al-Qaeda franchises around the world, the hardest core presence on the ground, the most entrenched presence on the ground. And so even if you do see Aleppo fall and Assad absorb more territory, that the war is still a long way from over. And there's also this ongoing question of who wins out of this. The fact is that Syria has long been, for decades, an ally of Russia. One of the reasons Russia became so involved was in part because it didn't want to lose this strategic ally. And so when we talk about the loss of Syria, it's not as if the Russians are for the first time moving into Syria. Mm-hmm. This is a country which has been at the core, one of its only allies in among two dozen Arab countries.
Robin Wright, Joshua Landis, please stand by. Stephen Simon joins us right now from New York, professor at Amherst College. He's former senior director for Middle East and North Africa at the National Security Council in the Obama administration. Also worked at the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. Author of the forthcoming, and this title sounds relevant now, The Long Goodbye, the U.S. and the Middle East from the Islamic Revolution to the Arab Spring. Stephen Simon, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure's all mine.
What do you see unfolding strategically right now in the Assad forces' apparent steamrolling of Aleppo? If that goes on, what's unfolding in front of us, Stephen?
What's unfolding in front of us is more or less what was described. Syria will, much of Syria, I think, will fall back under the control of the Assad regime. It will be ugly. And reconstruction will be extremely difficult. The Russians, I think, will stay involved for the long haul, as will the Iranians. I think, you know, the Iranians have a tremendous strategic stake in Syria, in part because it's the bridge to Lebanon, which is in effect the Iranian border with Israel. So I think, you know, they're incentivized to stay for the long haul. How happy the Syrian regime will be about that remains to be seen. From the beginning, the Syrian regime was concerned about the fact that once in, the Iranians wouldn't leave. So, you know, that will be, I think, a complicating factor in Syria's future.
For Americans watching this, Stephen Simon, it can seem like such a welter of interests at play here. What does all of this mean for the United States? I mean, clearly, it looks like a U.S. loss. The U.S. said Washington said Assad will go. He's not, he appears to be winning instead. Russia's coming in a very heavy way. Iran there. But describe for us what this means in strategic terms for the U.S.
Well, I don't know. To say that the U.S. lost something is to suggest that it had it to begin with. And that's not something that I think the historical record would support.
Well, there was certainly the expectation laid out by Washington that Assad would go. I heard Hillary Clinton say that again and again. I heard Barack Obama presume that in his speeches. John Kerry.
Yeah, they did say that. They said that Assad should step aside and make way for a democratic transition in Syria. It was an aspirational statement. But I have to say that the administration, I don't think, ever made any statement to the effect that the United States was going to be in the business of making that happen, of producing that outcome. it took steps to weaken the regime in order to give the opposition a leg up, and it provided arms and training to certain units within the opposition to give them a leg up. But it was never, the administration was never going to go beyond that, because it was going to confine its involvement to the degree that the outcome affected U.S. interests.
Well, what does that mean when the Washington says he'll go, he'll be gone, but then doesn't get involved to make it happen and it goes the other way? What's the significance of that? Is there some?
I think, you know, the administration tried very hard to avoid pinning its prestige to the outcome of this battle. So, you know, I'm not really sure what the penalties are for the United States in that, you know, Assad will probably remain in power and probably for a while.
Josh Landis, this isn't just about appearances, I guess. I mean, it's about what people are suffering, and it's about where power flows and what the future looks like here. But and yes, the U.S. did not come in heavy in Syria, that's for sure. But this is clearly not what the picture that was painted 3, 4, 5 years ago when this began. What does it mean? Is it a net benefit for the U.S. in the end, because there's going to be a consolidation here that will help ISIS go away? What about U.S. interest here, Josh?
Well, I think the U.S. does take a hit. It takes a hit in a number of ways. One, democracy promotion has really been all but abandoned by our new president-elect. And
what about
it's
our
not
sitting
just
president, Obama?
Well, it has been abandoned by Obama as well, and it's been abandoned by most Americans. The notion of regime change really switched in this election cycle when we heard President-elect Trump in the campaign say, you know, Libya was a bad idea and that Hillary Clinton screwed up and that chaos, spread of extremism, and he called Iraq the Harvard of jihadism. And he basically just whacked the last 20 years of American foreign policy, which is we can change these bad regimes and get a better outcome. And most of his competitors caved. We saw in Texas the Cruz said, you know, you're right, and he moved from being more of a neocon to being a being more like Trump. Everybody began to copy Trump's rhetoric, and that's because I think America has lost its confidence in its ability to produce democracy in the Middle East, for sure. Maybe not in the other parts of the world, but that kind of experiment, I think it's going to be a long time before the United States gets involved in that. And it also hurts America's allies in the region. Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey are all beside themselves with anger at the United States for not producing exactly the outcome that you described, for not getting a Sunni ascendancy and the rebels to win in Syria. So that is, you know, that it shows that America is not the superpower that it had been for the previous, you know, perhaps 50 years.
Stephen Simon, do you expect Donald Trump to accept Iranian, in a way, victory here, or to come in on the side of the rebels somehow, even now, in Syria, and try and push back against that outcome?
Yeah, before I turn to that, I need to talk a little bit about American interest, because interest has been a missing component of this conversation, particularly the last few minutes of it. If it were really important to the United States to side with either Sunnis or Shiites in the Middle East and to help one side or the other establish political dominance, then the U.S. would prioritize and it would intervene. But the perception, quite apart from the failure of the United States to carry out successful regime change in the past, there is a calculated sense within the administration, and it was already there in the second term of the Bush administration, which negotiated the exit arrangement for American forces from Iraq, that the stake in the American stake in Sunni dominance of the Middle East was simply incommensurate with the burdens of regime change. It was a calculated decision. So, you know, To say that the United States isn't the superpower that it was, first of all, you know, that's completely self-evident. You know, if you compare the United States now to the United States in 1955, you know, there's been relative decline.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Syria and the Middle East as Assad, or if Assad, wins there. He now looks set to take Aleppo, and maybe a big chunk of the wider civil war there. We're looking at where that leaves the country, its people, the region, the U.S., Russia, Iran. It's a big picture. Stephen Simon is with us from Amherst College, was on the National Security Council, working there in the Obama and Clinton administrations. Joshua Landis is with us from the University of Oklahoma, the Center of Middle East Studies there. Robin Wright joins us from The New Yorker. She's just back from the region, and you can link to her reporting there at our website, onpointradio.org. Government forces, regime forces, making serious gains in eastern Aleppo. Here, they've been busing local families who sided with the government back to their neighborhoods in the eastern part of the city. Here in a BBC report, one of those families celebrates that return.
I kiss your soil, Syria, Fadia cries. We kneel before you, Bashar.
We kneel before you, Bashar al-Assad. And of course, we've got a new administration coming in, Donald Trump. Where he goes with this, who knows? He's been friendly with Moscow, but he's been distinctly unfriendly toward Iran. During the second presidential debate in October, he said U.S. foreign policy in Syria has been too weak, that the Obama administration was leaving it to others to do the dirty work of destroying ISIS.
Assad is killing ISIS. Russia is killing ISIS, and Iran is killing ISIS. And those three have now lined up because of our weak foreign policy.
Robin Wright, what do you see facing President-elect, soon President Donald Trump, as he takes office and looks out on this region with his instincts and with the reality unfolding in front of him?
To be honest, I have no idea what Donald Trump is likely to do on Syria. He's indicated that he wants to be stronger, tougher, but no one knows what that means. You know, the inclination is to believe that he wants to see the war resolved in a way that removes this as a front page story every day. But the fact is the United States has never under the Obama administration had very appealing options. The reality was that the rebels were never strong enough to take on President Assad's regime long term. They could do it in pockets of the country, but not nationwide. There were very limited ability unless the United States got involved on the ground with massive troops as we did in Iraq. And that was not a popular option for the American public. The administration was wary of what that would mean long term in terms of human capital, financial resources, America's image. And so I think Donald Trump will inherit a situation where that is still true. I'm not sure Americans want to get more involved in Syria. There are certainly fewer options because of the loss by the rebels. So when he looks at it, he has fewer options than the Obama administration did, and none of them in terms of helping those who reflect American values or who are opposed to the kind of tactics and strategy and politics of the Assad regime. You know, the alternatives are not very viable.
I want to go to our listeners. Springfield, Ohio, Bill is calling. Hi, Bill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hey, Tom, thank you for your time. And I want to apologize. I was waved through to yesterday's conversation, and while trying to gather my thoughts, I disconnected the phone.
No problem. You're here. What's on your mind, Bill?
Well, hey, this one, I have a lot of concerns, and one started with kind of the intro to this, and I appreciate that I feel like I'm getting a much more balanced, nuanced discussion of this than, say, yesterday's conversation, but one concern I have is in your intro, you say this was a United States plan, this is Iran and Russia and Syria. And I think one thing to remember is those guys are all allies, I mean, strategic allies. If we pick a fight with Syria, we're making a war with Russia and Iran, and maybe, I'm not sure about this, but I think Iran is allied with China, too. So I think we need to be real careful. I think the United States' experiments in regime change has made a holocaust of North Africa and the Middle East. I mean, look at what happened in Iraq, look what happened in Libya, Honduras. I know that's
Bill, we got it. I appreciate your call. Let's take this issue of U.S. interest now. Stephen Simon, on the one hand, Donald Trump is very, very aggressively leaned and spoken against Iran. On the other hand, here's Iran, along with Russia and Syria. Now, Josh Landis calls it a Shia crescent. How does Trump deal with that? That conflict? Does he want to accept this and see Iran's influence extended? Or is there some sense in which he needs to oppose it because he opposes the rise of Iranian power, Stephen Simon?
Well, you know, one would think that at some point soon the administration, the president-elect is going to have to start prioritizing interests. I don't think it's going to be easy to do this. The new administration is going to be confrontational in its approach to Iran. The only place really to push back on Iran, unless the administration also decides to jettison the nuclear agreement that we did with Iran, the only place to push back is in Syria. That's it. Because that's where the Syrians are most active. That's where the Iranians are most active and are presumably vulnerable to U.S. Pushback. But if he does that, he will run into problems with Russia. And he has staked out a very congenial view of the U.S.-Russian relationship, and he seems to get along well with Putin, or certainly wants to get along with him. And he views the Assad regime and Putin as allies in the war against ISIS, which he has said he wants to step up. So this is a conflict of interest that will have to be sorted out as the administration approaches Inauguration Day. And the policy review process that will come immediately afterward. But the Russian angle is, as the caller suggests, going to be a seriously constraining element.
Josh Landis, how do you see this working out? Donald Trump warm to Russia, very cold to Iran. How does he sort out that contradiction?
Well, I think he's going to try to avert his eyes from Syria, and he'll want to take on ISIS. But I don't think he's going to want to get involved in, you know, who's on first in Syria. And, you know, if I could shift the conversation a bit, in a sense, in this aftermath of Syria, we are seeing a Arab Spring that has not really borne the kind of hopes or the fruit that one had hoped in terms of democracy.
To say the least. I mean, it's like a total disaster.
It is a disaster, and we're seeing the same problems now beset Syria, which is a big youth bulge, no employment, bad government, corruption, people hungry for more freedom. But globalization, which has hammered America and caused, you know, Europe and America to move right and more populism, has caused places like the Middle East – to governments to collapse because they couldn't provide the same kind of goods that they had promised the people they would get, subsidies and so forth. Mm-hmm. And this is a bigger problem that – and I think in the Middle East in some ways is a canary in the mine shaft, because we're going to see this play out in Africa and other countries that have been less than successful in dealing with globalization. China, India, Brazil, many countries have been successful, grown at fast rates, dragged people from poverty into the middle class, a tremendous clip. But other countries are, in a sense, the losers out of this because they haven't been able to produce good government, good education, provide jobs. And we're seeing them crumble. And this has been from one end of the Middle East to the other. We've watched this process. And I fear, you know, the refugee flows, the anxiety of the first world about letting in foreigners, these problems are not going to be solved anytime soon. And for the new administration coming in, they're going to have to figure out how they're going to deal with this in ways other than just building a bigger wall, because there is going to be more failed regimes out there.
That's a tall order, and a wash in blood in Syria, that crumbling. Cameron in Nashville, Tennessee. Cameron, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hi to your guest. Mm-hmm. I hope you give me some time. I've been waiting for 40 minutes because your topic is great, your speakers. My background, I am a Kurdish American. I came to this country in 1999. I've seen three administrations going to the next administration. I saw fall of Saddam, Gaddafi, and now Bashar. Be honest with you, what I see in here, American, especially the foreign policy, we are not honest. We are not consistency for backing up democracy. One of your speaker greatly alluded, for example, taking Iraq. After Iraq went, the United States went there. I heard from my friends, my families, I see in American people were very happy. The dictatorship is passing.
Yep. Saddam.
People lining up, complaining. Yep. American put offices. But now what happened in North Iraq? What I see, American generally treating Middle East like oil field. Just companies going, getting the oil. They do not invest in democracy, the rule of law. In Northern Iraq, it's been a year we have a parliament has been disabled and these guys stay on power. President expires. The war on Daesh is priority. And what's breeding these Islamist despair is the young generation. They don't see hope. There is no backing up when there is opposition coming on power in Turkey. I see a lot of hearing about Iran. Iran is our enemies. What about Saudis? What about Turkey? They are not our allies. Erdogan is prisoning our opposition party, kicking out the Kurdish party which elected. They imprisoned the media.
Cameron, should the U.S. just stay out of it? What do you want to see? I hear the depth of your cynicism, skepticism, but what do you want to see?
No, I don't want the United States to get out because I came to this country with a lot of hopes. I went to university. I was 20 years old, now 36. I have a child. I fear, like, for example, for my family now. In northern Iraq, they say, we wish Saddam coming back because at least he was providing 24-hour electricity and the money. For 5 months, there is no money, but there is the oil is going. Where the money is going? I want the United States to be accountable, to be on the side of democracy. When there is violations, we not only handshaking these people who come on power and the business go normal. You know, like for short term, it may work. But in the long term, it's not going to work. I don't want like people to be disappointed because they were progressive. People, they want to change. They see Americans. They see the media, especially social media. You may not believe it. When Trump speaking up and got elected, there was a lot of booms in there because he was saying, you know, I'm going to fight Daesh with Russian. Because they saw like President Obama and previous administrations, they were not honest. You know, I don't want like, for example, we fight in short-term wars. But at the long term, we will abandon democracy. The slogan, that's always in media we say. We say, okay, these people are hungry for freedom, but why are we not backing them up?
Cameron, we've got it. I'm glad you waited. You've taken us deep, and I appreciate it. Robin Wright, there's a cry from the heart from Cameron for the United States to stand up for democracy in this region. But I don't hear much in the way of that in our conversation today. That was certainly what George W. Bush said when we went into Iraq, and we saw what happened there. I mean, at this point, you've got Stephen Simon saying the U.S. doesn't even have a stake in whether it's Sunni or Shia. What is the American stake here, Robin?
Well, President Obama made a dramatic statement during the early days of the Arab Spring and said that the United States had been too often accommodating of stability in the region as a priority over our own democratic values. And that was when he called on President Mubarak in Egypt to step down. And the truth is we have now flip-flopped on that. And there is a yearning, I think, because of the instability, the wars, the human devastation, the destruction across the region to return to a point where we tolerate the autocrats in order to foster stability. We see that play out in Egypt where President el-Sisi is as brutal and possibly even more brutal than Hosni Mubarak was. We're not using the kind of language of democracy we once did. There's a sense that the social order has been so turbulent, so challenged, so changed that the priority now is to try to get to a point of quiet where societies can rebuild whoever is in power. And that's a sad reflection. I do think the Arab Spring did become an Arab earthquake, but I also think that the basic components that fostered that pivotal turning point, historic turning point for the region, are still there, whether it's the education and literacy of the young, whether it's the access to technology and information so that people know what has happened elsewhere in the world in terms of change, where you have such a young demographic, you know, up to two-thirds of societies across the region are under 30, that those elements are still there. The fact is that those who opposed old systems, whether it was in Syria or Egypt or Yemen or Libya or elsewhere, didn't have the resources, the network, the political parties, the instruments, the tools to change societies. They knew how to oppose and not how to reconstruct something different. And I think it's going to be a long time before we get there. And as a result, we're likely to see instability in Syria and its neighboring countries for some time to come. This is a moment, a decade, a generation of change. And unfortunately, Aleppo is not going to be the last big battle we see in the region.
Stephen Simon, do you see that hope for quiet to come, even if that means letting go of all kinds of aspirations of political progress there? Or do you see proxy war, bigger war, Saudi versus Iran?
Excuse me. Look, I think the structural factors that both Robin and Josh have referred to are going to determine the future. The only thing that they left out of an impressive list of really insuperable issues is climate, which was a contributing factor to the drought that in turn triggered the Syrian rebellion in 2011. The West, the United States and its allies, don't have the resources to pull the Middle East through the crisis that it's now undergoing. That's too bad. But, you know, the lack of resources also combines with, to some degree, of lack of interest, owing to, a change in the way that U.S. interests have evolved over time. And that relates to oil, as the previous caller said, I think, quite eloquently. Oil is a big issue for the United States, has been historically, but its importance is lessening now, actually. And U.S. interest is diminishing accordingly. And then, you know, against the background of these factors, you have the costly failures in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. And these are very discouraging to those who would say, well, you know, our interest remains strong in the Middle East and we need to allocate the resources.
That's as far as we can go today. Stephen Simon, I appreciate your being with us. Joshua Landis at the University of Oklahoma. Robin Wright with The New Yorker. A note of doom there. Maybe some healing. We'll hope. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.